The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit. This is a special Short Circuit in a few different ways. First of all, and unfortunately for you, our host and producer, John Ross, is not here this week. Instead, you get me, Anthony Sanders, director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. And this week, we're not talking about zany opinions from the federal courts of appeals. No, in memoriam for the recently departed Terry Jones of Monty Python, now for something completely different. We're talking about nationwide injunctions. You can't swing a cat these days without hitting someone with an opinion about nationwide injunctions. And we're talking about them with a special guest, Scott Keller, former Solicitor General for the state of Texas. Scott, welcome to Short Circuit.
Great to be with you.
Not only is Scott the former Solicitor General for the state of Texas, he is currently a partner at Baker Botts, where he chairs the firm's Supreme Court and constitutional law practice. A graduate of the University of Texas School of Law and a former clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy, he has argued numerous cases at the United States Supreme Court, including some we're going to talk about today. And while he was at the Solicitor General's office, a few times he asked for something called a nationwide injunction. So, Scott, what's a nationwide injunction? Or wait, for the benefit of our non-lawyer listeners, and I know there's a few out there, what's an injunction?
Well, an injunction is pretty simple. It's an order from a court, and it tells a party, you can't take a certain action. Now, that's in contrast with, say, money damages. A party goes to court and says, you've breached a contract, or you've committed a tort, and I've suffered all these damages, and you need to pay me to make up for that. So we're not talking about money, but rather we're talking about an order blocking someone from taking an action.
And you can have injunctions in all kinds of cases that have nothing to do with the government, right?
Absolutely. You know, injunctions, an injunction is just a very core power of a court in our judicial system. So nationwide injunctions, of course, are going to be called injunctions on steroids, but bread and butter injunctions have existed in our system since its inception. They've existed in the English common law, where our law has come from. And so just injunctions in general, that's not the controversial part.
And so when we hear nationwide injunctions, and I hear people who know a bit about it more than just the talking heads on TV, they use this term called universal injunction. And if you could explain what that is.
Yeah, so the phrase nationwide injunction is a bit of a misnomer. It's not the fact that the injunction would apply in all 50 states that is what is the, call it, interesting or different aspect of the injunction. Rather, the reason why some have referred to it as universal or a cosmic injunction is the injunction is designed not to just run against the parties who are the plaintiffs bringing the lawsuit, but rather the injunction can benefit parties who are not actually in the lawsuit. In other words, it would tell the defendant, you can't take that action. But not only can you not take that action against these particular plaintiffs who brought the lawsuit, you can't take that action against any other plaintiff anywhere. And it's that feature of a nationwide injunction or a universal or a cosmic injunction that is the distinguishing factor and why these are controversial.
And so an injunction, so in the context of the government, often, not always, but often it's in the constitutional case, right? So law is passed that bans some kind of speech. There's a case brought, an injunction is awarded, banning the government from enforcing that law. But it's beyond just the people who brought the lawsuit. That would be an example of a universal injunction, right?
Yeah, I suppose the caveat to that would be, maybe it's not universal if it would only run against some parties, third parties who are not part of the lawsuit, whereas I guess a universal or a cosmic injunction would run against anybody that the government would possibly want to enforce that law against.
And is there, so just taking that in the abstract, is there anything inherently wrong with that, or is it just contrary to all tradition that you would have a universal injunction against the government?
Well, so, and this is part of the big debate. For at least a few decades, it's pretty clear that courts have in fact issued these types of injunctions. And we may get into this a little bit later, but to bring up another term in lawyer parlance, facial challenge versus as applied challenge, this issue about nationwide injunctions, in my opinion, dovetails with what the courts have been grappling with for the last few decades about facial versus as applied challenges. That is, when a party brings a lawsuit, are they challenging the law and the particularities of how it is being applied to that one single plaintiff? Or are they challenging it no matter how that law could possibly be applied to any plaintiff? And you can see why, if you're challenging something facially, if you're challenging it in all the circumstances it could possibly be applied in, well, then maybe an injunction should run against that law if it's really unlawful in all its applications. Of course, therein lies the rub. Some would say that, well, even if you were raising those types of legal arguments that would apply to anybody, the injunction still should only run to you, the particular plaintiff, and you shouldn't be able to get nationwide universal injunctions.
Well, let's dig it. That's a fascinating point, and let's dig into that in a little bit. First, I just wanted you to tell us your experience when you were a solicitor general in Texas and you asked for some of these nationwide injunctions and got some. Give us a couple examples of it, how that went and what was involved and why the courts would give you that injunction versus some other relief.
Yeah, so the first thing I'd say is, yes, when I was the solicitor general of Texas, we asked for nationwide injunctions on a few occasions. We were cognizant that asking for a nationwide injunction was a big deal. And so we didn't want to ask for nationwide injunctions every time we were possibly challenging, you know, a federal administrative agency action. Rather, they were select cases. And I think the most notable example was probably the DAPA litigation, the Deferred Action Program, the second Deferred Action Program from the Obama administration, in which Texas led a coalition of 26 states in obtaining an injunction blocking that DAPA, that second Deferred Action Program, from coming online, and obtained a nationwide injunction in doing so. Now, the arguments that Texas was making there were tailored towards that particular program. And I think that would distinguish the DAPA litigation from many of the other nationwide injunctions we've been seeing. And the argument there was, you have 26 states suing. DAPA said that an individual who was otherwise unlawfully present in the country would be deemed lawfully present. Well, you can't be lawfully present in one state but unlawfully present in another state, because lawful presence is, are you lawfully present in the United States or not? And so the main argument we raised there and to obtain a nationwide injunction is there's no way to run a system where somehow you can only have an injunction running to these 26 states saying, well, these individuals are still unlawfully present in these states, but they're going to be lawfully present in other states. There was also the issue there of, you know, there's obviously no barriers between states. People can move between states. That's a good thing. But practically what that meant was, if someone could be lawfully present in California, well, they could move to Texas. And what do you do about that situation? In other words, it would be so, there would be no way to administer that system. And that's what the Fifth Circuit said as to why Texas should get that nationwide injunction. Now, the reason I explain all that nuance is those were arguments that were tailored to this particular program and the administration of how that program would work as a practical matter. Most of the nationwide injunctions we've seen in the last few years don't do that analysis.
So give an example. So I know that we had some nationwide injunctions under Obama. We've now had some nationwide injunctions under Trump. Some of the less thoughtful people out there, it seems like, just have kind of switched sides on their opinions on these issues with that change. But I know there's probably some more nuance to that you'd like to elucidate on. So give us an example of an injunction or two in the last couple of years and why that was not as grounded as the example you gave.
I think the best example I could point to comes out of Chicago. And there, cities, particularly Chicago, challenged a Trump administration agency directive that said, if you are going to be a sanctuary city, if you are not going to cooperate with the federal government in immigration enforcement, we are going to pull certain federal funds from the Department of Justice grant programs. There was a lawsuit by the cities, and in particular the city of Chicago, maybe a few others, but anyway, just a few cities. And they said, you can't just pull funding like that. Only Congress can do that. You can't do that through an administrative procedure. The district court there said, you're right. That is unlawful to do. But after finding it unlawful on the merits, when it proceeded to the remedy as to what injunction it should issue, the district court issued a nationwide injunction saying, for all cities and all states and all governments, Trump administration can't do that. Well, if you think about it, the city of Chicago, if it gets its money from this grant program, that injunction should take care of all of its injury. There's nothing inherent about it needs to make sure other states or other cities actually get that relief. An even more pointed example of why that injunction was so overbroad was the state of Texas had passed legislation, its state legislature did, saying its cities had to comply with federal government directives in helping with immigration enforcement. So that injunction would be completely ineffective and useless for any entity in the entire state of Texas. So there was just no need for a nationwide injunction. And the Seventh Circuit actually did stay that nationwide injunction issued by the district court pending appeal. But I raise that example of one of, there are many times where plaintiffs, I think, anytime they challenge a federal administrative action, want to say we should get a nationwide injunction. And I think that's an example where, well, if we're going to actually look at the practicalities of how these injunctions operate, by the way, there's an argument that we shouldn't, and I know we'll get to that in a bit. But if we're going to look at the practicalities, that's one where it's really hard to say that that plaintiff needed a nationwide injunction to somehow remedy its own injury.
Now, let's look at – I want to get back to those examples. Let's look at another case with universal injunctions. And so we often have lawsuits against we at IJ bring many of them against states or cities or counties or what have you level of local government that has some law that's challenged as unconstitutional or unlawful and is enjoined. And it's enjoined, of course, statewide or citywide, but beyond just the plaintiffs. And you don't hear about a lot of controversy about that.
Oh, that's, I mean, right.
Maybe some academics have quibbled with it, but it doesn't get into the news. And obviously, there's a difference. Nationwide is a bigger area. It's a different level of government. And so it makes sense that it would be a bigger area in some ways. But there's not that controversy. So is there something different about them other than just the obvious geography? Or is it, because conceptually, it seems like the same thing.
As a matter of legal principle, I believe that it is the same. It's whether the injunction is running against third parties. Now, I think what makes it maybe optically different is the best way to put it, is look, even the phrasing nationwide injunction, that's a phrase that the U.S. Department of Justice has created. And I think the difference there is they could possibly be litigating those cases in multiple circuits, and you'd have multiple inputs. You'd have, in Supreme Court parlance, it's called percolation. You have many different lower court opinions addressing an issue, so that by the time the Supreme Court addresses that, they're going to have the benefit of various opinions raising all the best arguments, and then they're going to be able to come to the best decision they can. In contrast, I mean, we saw this all the time down in Texas, you know, a few voters would bring a lawsuit challenging the Texas voter ID law, or, you know, a couple abortion clinics would file a lawsuit challenging, you know, a state abortion law, and district courts would issue injunctions. And when those injunctions ran statewide, no one batted an eye. However, that is the same legal principle we're talking about.
Right.
The injunction would tell the government, the defendant, the government officials, you can't apply this to anyone in the state.
And there's more than one district in Texas, right? More than one federal district.
Yeah, there are four federal districts in Texas. And so, but the difference there, of course, would be all of those appeals would go to one circuit, the Fifth Circuit, and then the Supreme Court could take that case or not. So you could still have percolation of the legal issue at a higher level of generality, but it wouldn't be about that particular law in the same way that I think the federal government, the Department of Justice, has pushed this argument that, well, anytime someone's going to get a nationwide injunction of a federal administrative action, unless there's a statute that, say, directs it that you have to bring that suit in the D.C. Circuit, you could have litigation all over the country about this, and that would, as a practical matter, be a good thing for the Supreme Court to hear all these different views. Now, again, I say that as a practical matter. That's not a conceptual, you know, principle of law that would need to be. But, you know, when we're talking about the equitable powers of courts, and that's what this is, when courts should issue a particular injunction, I think all of those equitable factors can come to bear.
That one thing that we've seen a lot in the Trump administration is when these nationwide injunctions are issued that the Solicitor General maybe a short stop at the circuit court, but then goes to the Supreme Court to try to get relief, especially in a preliminary injunction context. And this, of course, happened with the travel ban litigation, but others as well. And I know there's been a lot of howling about how that's out of the ordinary to get to the Supreme Court. But then, of course, there's the other side. But you just said that if there's a nationwide injunction, then in the meantime, that's the only way to get out of that because it's affecting the whole country. You don't have the normal percolation to wait for. But couldn't it be said that, you know, when I think we're not far in age, and when we were born, the Supreme Court was a place that had about 150 cases a year. Now it has about 75 cases a year. Couldn't it be said that the court has a little bit of room that it can step in and deal with these? And even though there's no percolation, you don't have eight different courts of appeals writing nice opinions that it can pick and choose from. Still, the issue could get there and it could deal with it. And we live in an age of lots of administrative regulations. And so there's an argument that that's the role they could fill.
Well, it's certainly out of the ordinary for the U.S. Solicitor General to be running to the court on all these emergency stay applications. But I feel for the Solicitor General because it's also out of the ordinary to be seeking and obtaining the number and breadth of nationwide injunctions that we've seen in this administration. And I think a big part of this debate that is always hard to get at is usually these types of cases where you're asking for a nationwide injunction to block a federal administrative action, they typically come up in politically sensitive areas and politically charged areas. And really, in my opinion, what we should be looking for is a neutral principle. The neutral principle should be the rule that would apply whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration, whether you like the policy, whether you dislike the policy. And it's very hard, I think, sometimes to think about, you know, what is the neutral policy for a remedial equitable doctrine about injunctions and when they should apply universally or nationwide when you're talking about, you know, insert your topic, DAPA, the Affordable Care Act contraception mandate, sanctuary cities. These are all the, you know, policy issues that our nation's grappling with right now. Unfortunately, they happen to be popping up rather than be in the courts rather than being solved by Congress. And I think that's another point to this whole debate. You know, we got to this situation where we have all these nationwide injunctions or requests for this because these lawsuits are almost all about challenging federal administrative action. If Congress was passing statutes and lawsuits were being brought trying to challenge those, first of all, there wouldn't be nearly the amount of legal claims available because the Administrative Procedure Act wouldn't apply, which gives various avenues to challenge agency actions. Administrative agencies have to jump through additional hoops. Congress has its own set of procedures, but once Congress passes a statute, you don't have all these other available challenges. And so that is also what's fueling this, is you have Congress passing fewer laws. You do have state attorneys general who have, you know, call it seen the Texas playbook or otherwise, that challenging federal administrative action, asking for nationwide injunctions, that is an avenue available to them. And then you have that combined with, you know, the Supreme Court, naturally, too, that they see all this. And look, I feel for them that the justices don't want to have to be dealing with these weighty, sensitive legal issues bearing on highly controversial political decisions in the context of emergency stay applications where they get a few briefs and have to make up some decision within a week or so. I mean, I don't think anyone would say that this is the best way to do this. And so then the question is, well, what do you do about it? There have been some various proposals about nationwide injunctions, and maybe that Congress should step in. Again, if Congress passes a statute saying this is when you get a nationwide injunction, this is when you don't. Or the court's going to have to at some point clarify the standard. I saw in the recent cert grant in the Affordable Care Act contraception mandate, in one of those two cases, one of the issues presented deals with the nationwide injunction in that case. Now, of course, if the court would rule that on the merits that the Trump administration's religious exemption to the Affordable Care Act contraception mandate was valid, you wouldn't reach that remedial injunction issue. But I just flagged that as these issues are starting to get up to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. I know we used to, I mean, it still happens very rarely in a few cases, but it used to be that a lot of cases would be decided by three-judge panels when they were these constitutional challenges, and you could have a similar thing for administrative challenges. Could that be a way to deal with this kind of, you know, you don't want to be too hard on someone who, you know, lives in Alaska and has to come to D.C. to file a case that challenge a law, but maybe there's a way, such as the MDL litigation that the lawyers will know what I'm talking about, where you have lawsuits in different states and they're amalgamated into one because they all have to do with the same thing. Is there some mechanism like that that could sort this out and maybe be a compromise between the various voices on this?
Well, you mentioned three-judge panels. They would require Congress to pass a statute, but Judge Costa in the Fifth Circuit has suggested just that the way to solve this is actually if a plaintiff is going to plead for or request or ask for a nationwide injunction, then that should actually go to a three-judge panel like we have for redistricting cases. There were formerly many more instances where a plaintiff in our federal court system would start before three judges in a district court, a trial court, and then there would be an automatic direct appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. That would be the proposal. Now, a downside to that, of course, is you're then foisting upon the Supreme Court more direct appeals that they must take. And I know the certiorari discretionary jurisdiction that they've carved out over the last few decades is something that the court, I think, genuinely wants to probably preserve, because it does allow them to reach an issue when, again, you've had those voices from the lower courts and from litigants presenting all the best arguments to them. But that is certainly one option. You know, another option would be Congress could pass a statute saying, here are the instances in which these are available and these are not. Because what if Congress can override common law principles such as, you know, when an injunction should issue as a matter of equity. Now, one issue I suppose we should talk about is, you know, this question that, well, maybe the Administrative Procedure Act already did that. There's this argument, and we raised it very, very briefly in the DAPA case, but there's this language in the APA that says that when a court finds a federal administrative agency action unlawful, it should, quote, set aside, unquote, that action. Well, there's an argument, the plain text argument and otherwise, that set aside means you need to take that action and nullify or scrap it or, you know, put it aside and it can have no effect. Well, if that's what you're doing, that would seem to run against many more people than just the particular plaintiffs in that lawsuit. Now, I know Professor Sam Bray has said, not so fast, set aside, actually, it was a term of art that actually didn't refer to that, and really, I think Professor Bray's argument, if I understand it correctly, is more about setting aside particular adjudications between certain parties. Now, I mean, I have to say, you know, I haven't gone back to see all the commentary on this particular argument since then, but the Administrative Procedure Act obviously dealt with a lot more than just adjudication. It dealt with notice and comment rulemaking, informal rulemaking. In fact, the APA has a formal rulemaking procedure, which is very little used today. So it's not that the APA just completely ignored adjudication. Anyway, whether that would be the type of argument that would prevail, I'm not sure. Of course, if you're going to take that tack, then all the practicalities about the equities and everything, all that would fade away. And rather, you'd say, well, Congress and the APA has directed that that's what should happen. Now, that's a direction about federal administrative action. What should happen in, you know, if you're challenging a congressional statute and succeed in doing that, whether you should get a nationwide injunction there, that would be a different set of issues. Another caveat on all this, of course, is, you know, when we're talking about this issue of nationwide injunctions as a practical matter, we're really talking about the opinions of lower courts. Because when the U.S. Supreme Court definitively addresses an issue and rules on the merits, on the substance, well, that sets precedent for the whole country. So any other litigant could then rely on that precedent to knock out that same law. So really what we're talking about in this is, what do you do before the U.S. Supreme Court definitively rules on the merits on an issue?
So I wanted to get to that issue with you bringing the public interest perspective that we and IJ deal with and people at all kinds of groups deal with when you bring a lawsuit, not just for your client, but you're bringing a lawsuit for a greater public interest. And so if you're challenging a law and the law goes to the U.S. Supreme Court and the Supreme Court rules it's unconstitutional, but there was no injunction, maybe you're only asking for declaratory judgment, or maybe it was a prosecution. Yeah, who cares, right, if you get an injunction at that point? I mean, you might have some renegade officials still enforcing the law after that, but that's not that likely. But if you get a victory in say, federal district court, and it's not appealed for whatever reason, and it's declared unconstitutional, and you're doing it as a public interest organization, or maybe it's some a state bringing it, but there's a wider public interest there, of course. But it just runs to the parties in the case, then it doesn't have nearly the same effect, right, as having an appellate victory. So one an appellate opinion that the law is unlawful or unconstitutional. So one worry that I think public interest attorneys have is if you had a world where you didn't have universal injunctions, or maybe it was very limited, you had universal injunctions, you could have a public interest lawsuit to try to challenge a law, and of course brought so not everyone has to bring these same cases. You win it, you get an injunction for your clients, maybe four people, maybe a class action even, but that's still maybe not everybody. But then the government doesn't appeal and they keep on enforcing the law, whether it's a state, a city, the federal government, what have you. Do you think that's, you know, a worry if we went too far over to the other side? And is that something compelling for, you know, keeping something close to what we have now?
Well, so I think it would be odd for the government to say, we're not going to appeal, but we're going to continue enforcing the law against others. Now, maybe that does happen, and that scenario strikes me as very odd that a government would make that choice. But okay. You know, you mentioned class actions, and that's something we haven't talked about yet. I think one of the biggest, call it, counter arguments to the existence of nationwide injunctions is the argument of, well, look, we have the class action mechanism. If you want an injunction running against all these parties, file for class certification, get a class, and then that entire class is they are all plaintiffs, and then an injunction that runs against the defendant as to the class, you have the parties before the court. Therefore, it's not a universal
right
type injunction. And look, that is a significant argument. There are practical issues with it. You know, for instance, if you are a coalition of states and you are seeking a universal injunction, how many times do you think California or Texas would agree to be part of each other's class in any of these lawsuits? Look, maybe some. I'm sure there are going to be some issues, but you know, for the most part, that's not going to happen. Now, I think the skeptic, though, to that would say, well, yeah, that's exactly the point, that they shouldn't be getting a nationwide injunction or a universal injunction there, because these policies should just run to the particular state plaintiffs. And then also as a practical matter, I know we keep talking about practicalities, but that's ultimately where this, I think, debate ends up. If a federal court declares unlawful a federal administrative action, the U.S. Supreme Court will probably review that case.
Right.
And so I think, to even put a finer point on what we're talking about, we're really talking about, when can the federal government enforce an administrative action in the time period between it issues that agency action and a nationwide injunction blocks it versus when the U.S. Supreme Court gets to actually hear that case. Now, that is not that issue should not be downplayed, because we've seen that with this administration. We've seen just this expansion of nationwide injunctions being issued in the district courts, and look at all of this administration's administrative actions that have been blocked. And here we are, you know, we're in the fourth year of the presidential term, and you could go down the list of the issues that they are still litigating out about nationwide injunctions that have been issued over the past few years. So this is, in some ways, you know, it is a series of lawsuits that have clearly, undoubtedly, and I think, you know, all of the blue state attorneys general would say this is what they were trying to do. They're trying to gum up the works of this administration's ability to take certain agency actions.
Do you think in some ways that you were, I think, alluding to this earlier? There was an opinion of the Supreme Court the end of last term. I can't remember which one, to tell you the truth right now, but it was one of the administrative law cases, big ones near the end of the term. And Justice Gorsuch said that, I think it was the non-delegation case and doctrine. And Justice Gorsuch said, you know, we haven't had the non-delegation doctrine much, but like hydraulic fluid, it's come up in other ways, in other areas of constitutional law, because it kind of has to. And it sounds like you're saying that, you know, we have this huge administrative state that many would argue isn't in keeping with the constitutional design. And yet that behemoth, slowing that behemoth down manifests itself in maybe other ways where if we had a more limited government, we wouldn't be talking about a lot of these controversies. Do you think there's something to that?
Well, and this goes back to the point that, well, Congress really isn't passing much legislation. If the people's representatives were creating legislation through whatever mechanism that is, because there's compromise or many people agree about, you know, 80% of a subset of issues on a particular topic and therefore legislation is passed, you wouldn't see all this litigation challenging, you know, was there sufficient, responsiveness to comments at the administrative phase, or, you know, they needed to use notice and comment procedure when they didn't. If legislation, in other words, all of the bevy of lawsuits that you can bring under the Administrative Procedure Act, you can't raise those claims against Congress. Congress, if it votes to pass legislation and both houses do and the president sign it, that's the law. There's no way to kind of nitpick that. Congress doesn't have to give an explanation. Agencies do. You know, and then there's litigation over, does an agency give a sufficiently reasoned explanation? That's, you know, a doctrine on the merits of administrative law, but that's almost always a claim that we're seeing in this, you know, recent spate of nationwide injunction cases. But anyway, that's to say that, yes, if Congress were passing more laws, I think this debate, I'm not even sure that we'd be having the debate.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to what you said about the government not appeal, it's like a state not appealing a case because it doesn't want to create that precedent and calling it odd. It does sound odd, but we actually have run into it at IJ in a few cases. The Washington Campaign Finance Board did that in one of our cases, saying that our plaintiffs who won the case were kind of like knights errant who could run all over the state violating this one statute because it was declared unconstitutional under the First Amendment, but nobody else could, which we found odd as well. But one other thing you brought up earlier that I really wanted to get to our time left is the facial as applied distinction. So we have, you know, most people understand basically what a facial challenge is. That's that the law as it's written just can't be applied to anybody, or it's so unconstitutional it has to be struck down, as they say. Then there's as applied, where you have really specific facts about a person or a group of people, and so it's unconstitutional to apply it to them for a particular, you know, in that particular case. But other people could be fine. But then there's something in between. A lot of our cases at IJ are this way, where it's the plaintiffs, but people similarly situated to them, it's unconstitutional. And that could be a wide class. You could bring it as a class action. It could be that it's pretty obvious what that situation would be, but it's not, you know, technically a facial challenge. And I think courts often get very confused by that on the merits and also on the remedy. And how do you think that then relates to this whole injunction debate?
Yeah, so to attempt to simplify what is not simple, the facial versus as applied distinction, the Supreme Court started using those terms a few decades ago. And at first, it wasn't quite clear, were they talking about the merits arguments or were they talking about the remedial injunction arguments? And I think there's still that discrepancy today.
Right. Didn't Citizens United, didn't they? They tried to sort that out a bit.
Citizens United, in a few cases since then, have kind of sorted it out to say that, you know, this isn't some sort of pleading requirement.
It's about the remedy.
Yeah, and I think that, but it is about the remedy. However, it is the remedy caused by the level of generality at which the merits argument is being made. So the example, or I will explain, at least I will attempt to explain what I mean by that.
That's right. For the first time.
That's right. That's right. So yeah, you mentioned if your legal argument is you could, that if you won on that legal point, that it would mean the statute or the agency action is unlawful in all of its applications. That's the standard the Supreme Court has said. Well, then I think everyone would agree that under the Supreme Court's precedence, that is clearly a facial challenge. But now notice that that would be a merits argument. If your argument is, well, the way the government in particular applied this just to me in my situation, think about Masterpiece Cake Shop, for instance.
Sure.
You know, there you had a state agency that the court held espoused religious animus in the course of adjudicating this one agency determination against the cake shop. Okay, well, that rationale applies. Now, the legal principle that, well, if there's religious animus, then it's unlawful. Okay, but the facts and that argument that was accepted there, that is at a very low level of generality. Now, you're going to have things in between then, as
right.
you mentioned, that if the legal argument wouldn't necessarily be it's unlawful in all applications, but it's unlawful in more applications than just this particular person, this is how you get into this this issue. But the reason that ties into the remedy and the injunction and the nationwide injunction issue is if your argument is at that highest level of generality, then I think the courts somewhat of a shorthand have said, well, look, we should actually just declare this facially unconstitutional. If we're accepting that legal premise that this argument is correct, and that means that the law could never be applied to anyone else, well, why let it sit out there and not clarify it? There's a big distinction here, though. It's when the U.S. Supreme Court is saying that, that's one thing, because it's setting nationwide precedent. But what does a circuit court do? What does a district court do? That's a different situation, and yet the circuit courts and district courts have been taking cues from the Supreme Court as to what a facial and as-applied distinction means for them. Right. And I think maybe what the Supreme Court may ultimately end up doing is something along the lines of saying, hey, look, we've been talking about facial as applied. We've been talking about it in the context of when we, the U.S. Supreme Court, the final arbiter who sets nationwide precedent, is issuing cases. This is what we mean. For lower courts, maybe that should mean something different. And I think that is how this also dovetails back to the nationwide injunction issue. When the Supreme Court sets precedent, of course, that's nationwide. But when lower courts do it, should their injunctions be running to other parties or parties outside their judicial districts? Well, this is, you know, I guess where the rubber meets the road right. In the debate.
I think before we go, I think some of our listeners would be remiss if we in talking about the Constitution and injunctions and all of that, we didn't bring up the O word of originalism and what originalism has to say about the judicial power in Article 3 and cases and controversies and equity and how that relates to any of this. I know, you know, we're practitioners, not in an ivory tower somewhere, but what's your understanding of what's been said about the original meaning of what's in Article 3 of the Constitution about the courts and how that relates to these kinds of remedies?
Yeah, so Justice Thomas has a separate opinion where he's skeptical of nationwide injunctions and goes into some of this. You know, at base, I think it's, you know, the text of Article 3 says the judicial power extends to cases or controversies. There is an argument that to resolve a case, you don't have to issue any form of injunction to any third party. Rather, you just say this defendant can't do that to the plaintiffs that sued. That resolves the case. That resolves the controversy. And therefore, there shouldn't be judicial power to issue these broader injunctions. Now, look, that is not how courts have treated that power. And I think there's decent evidence that even in English common law, and that's where obviously we weren't talking about originalism and seeing what was the practice in England that then we inherited in our system, that injunctions could run against people that were beyond just the particular plaintiffs and the defendant in the case. But again, this is part of the commentary that's going on right now in the academy, and you will obviously see these issues play out once the Supreme Court squarely addresses what is the proper scope of the injunctive power. But again, look, I mean, as someone who sought nationwide injunctions as a litigant representing a state, in some ways, you take these cases as they come and you take the precedents as they come. It was very clear that the existing precedent allows for this. I think your question really goes to, well, should all this precedent be changed? Is there a better way? Or will the Supreme Court or Congress step in and say, this is actually how these cases should progress? And first of all, that remains to be seen. But I will say, in the meantime, I don't think this issue is going away. Unless Congress starts to pass more legislation, you're going to continue to have really rulemakings and agency actions that are addressing all these very critical legal and policy issues. I think you're going to continue to see litigation from the states about this. And so this issue and these problems, I think, are part of that. So there may be even more collateral issues from all this, rather beyond just even the nationwide injunction issue.
One thing we do on Short Circuit, of course, and we talk about the opinions of the federal courts of appeals, is predict which ones might be going to the Supreme Court. You mentioned earlier a case that just got accepted that perhaps doesn't probably look like it, but perhaps could address the whole nationwide injunctions issue.
Well, it might, yeah.
How do you think if that one doesn't for whatever reason, or maybe they do, but they don't speak more broadly about the issue, how do you think this whole issue might squarely get to the court? And are there any other cases working their way out there that you think are teeing that up?
Well, so I think the way that it would get to the court is the court would have to say a certain federal administrative action is unlawful, but is the remedy, the injunction was improper. Or I suppose the federal government, in petitioning for cert to have the Supreme Court take the case, would have to concede that the policy was unlawful. I don't think that's going to be likely.
And so, that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, so right there, you're already thinking, like, well, oh, you have to get it in that posture, really, because if the court says this is lawful, well, then there's no need for any injunction. The court's never going to reach the issue about, well, was the scope of the injunction improper or not? So until the court actually has a case where there are five votes to say this federal action is unlawful, but the remedy, we need to talk about what the proper remedy is and whether the nationwide injunction aspect was proper or not. And even then, if the court were to address that issue, maybe they're only going to say, well, look, we look at this particular case and here we have these features and that's why this injunction in particular was right or wrong, but we're not going to say much more because we're not quite sure about this issue. I mean, there's a reason why the academy and everyone and all the state litigants, and even today we're having these debates, and like, these are hard issues. That doesn't mean that the first case the Supreme Court takes on this, all of a sudden there's going to magically be this answer that then appears and that's it. Rather, I mean, this might take some time. And that's also not a bad thing, that I think it'd be better to, again, come up with the neutral principle, get it right, rather than possibly inserting a legal doctrine that would just create more mischief.
What sounds like there might be many more opportunities to talk about nationwide injunctions, and perhaps one day when that time comes, we'll have Scott in again. But I'd like to thank Scott Keller for coming in to the studio today, and like to thank all of you for listening. Luckily, I will not be here next time that you see a podcast pop up on your device. It will be our normal host, John Ross, who will be telling you about all the latest with Short Circuit. Thanks, everyone.